The Guardian.
I love The Guardian. You know, I worked a Guardian Sudoku puzzle in the morning.
Did you do it still?
Oh, yeah. That's how I know whether I've overcome my jet lag, because the first day I was here, I mangled two easy puzzles, and I knew it was just brain mush. You know?
Absolutely.
Today I did it, no sweat.
I'm so impressed. That's really good. I can never do it. My daughter's good there.
It's practice.
Yeah, I'm sure. I want to ask you actually first about Africa generally. You know, you're here. How do you feel when you come to Africa? Is it really something special for you?
Always. It always has been. You know, I worked really hard on African issues when I was president. I spent a lot of time with African leaders. I had a conference on Africa and brought in a lot of ministers from around the continent to Washington, and we did a lot of work. And then my second term, I took the longest, most substantive trip an American president had ever taken, and we passed the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. We were paying for roughly 25-30% of what the world was then spending on AIDS, and we worked to set up the Global Fund, although it was formally stood up the month I left office, or the next month. We did all that work. So I've always been interested in it. And when I left office, I was always impressed by the potential of the place. I could never, it bothered me that everyone, first of all, that a lot of people in America, and I think a lot of the rest of the world, tended to think of Africa as a place instead of a continent. I mean, there are 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa alone. And secondly, I always saw it as a place of enormous potential. So I love doing this, and it's genuinely fun. I just met with all of our people while we were waiting for you to get in. I brought in all of the people in our AIDS operation here in Ethiopia. It's the biggest one in the world that we have.
Is that right?
And almost 10% of our... more than 10% of our AIDS staff. Yeah. What have we got? 78 people here.
Right.
And then, and we also have a climate change project in Addis, where we're working with the city, trying to completely redo their waste, their solid waste program, in a way that captures the methane and labels, gives them the option to use it as fuel, at least not to put it in the atmosphere, and improves the public health. But anyway, I just love doing this. I love going to these countries and seeing them develop the capacity and then to overcome their problems. And as you know, I'm sure a lot of these countries have had very brisk growth rates in the last couple of years. Now, this is going to be a tough year because there are, I think, 53 countries in the world with per capita incomes of $2 a day or less that import 70% or more of their oil, many of them in Africa. And many of those countries, even with the recent tapering off of the price, will find that their increased oil bill will equal or surpass the combined benefits of increased foreign assistance and the debt relief. So, you know, it's tough now, but I just think that it's a place of enormous promise, and I just love being here.
Yeah, there, a lot of people do tend to write it off. They say you can't help Africa. It's a basket case. You get those sort
They're
of
wrong.
Things, yeah.
But, I mean, look at the growth rate they had here last year. There are lots of African countries that have had growth rates between 5 and 11% the last 2 or 3 years. In my second term as president, 3 of the 6 fastest growing economies during my second term in the world, admittedly from a low base, but in percentage terms, were African countries. Mozambique was going like crazy until the flood, you know, at the end of the 90s. And it took a while to bounce back from that. But they're just wrong. It's like every place else. If you get any basket of 48 countries, you're going to have wide variations in the quality of political leadership and the political culture and the administrative capacity of the government, but there's enormous promise.
You mentioned climate change. Is that what attracted you to the project today that we saw?
Yes, and because I think it's also good economics. My whole theory about climate change is that the biggest problem in the aggregate, obviously, is the fact that both China and India are about to surpass the United States in emissions. And no country is going to agree to remain poor in order to avert climate change. They'll just say to the rich countries, you do better. So we have to be able to show that there are economically viable options, first. Second, I think it is really important that the vast mass of countries that are developing or just a little above that find ways to, in effect, skip the carbon stage of economic development that actually accelerate rather than undermine their well-being. So the reason I wanted to go to that site is that these people are, they're not in my foundation, you know, they work, they made this commitment at the Clinton Global Initiative to do this. But I'm always looking for ways to try to take things that are working to scale. And the great thing about what they did there is they found a way to make the economics work for the people in villages. The biggest problem in the U.S. and every place else on solar energy is that the cost per kilowatt hour in the short run is still greater than other forms of clean energy and other forms of not clean energy. But the reason is all the cost for solar is up front. And only the public utilities are organized for 20-year time horizons. The average person doesn't even live in a house for 20 years anymore.
Yeah.
But for these people, because of the scale of the solar reflector, and because it has the capacity, as you saw, to light that big room where the class was there, I think that it's a really good model. And we're going to go back and figure out what we can do, because I think there are many, many countries in Africa where the last thing they need to be worried about now is trying to put everybody on a centralized power grid, mm-hmm. which you need to be able to meet the current and projected future power needs of families and communities and whatever economic growth you project you can achieve in a given region. And I just think this is the best way to do it. I think it makes a lot more sense. It is, as I think one of the men commented to you today, it's the sort of energy equivalent of the cell phone movement. I really wanted to go up there and see it because there are, we've done some work with the Solar Electric Light Foundation, those people. And some of their work you might even be able to do in the short run for a little less money, but I'm not sure that the model is as sustainable as this one. This is really, he's done something good here.
Yeah.
I think
you may be right. When some people say we should maybe look to America and Europe to be doing a bit more before we start telling Africa what to do, that's the only question.
I think they're right, but the point is I think that the United States does need to pass climate change legislation. We need to put a price on carbon. We need to set up a cap and trade system and one that can't be cheated on. I agree with all that. But I have two reactions to it. When people say that most loudly, they're usually looking for an excuse to do nothing. And if we burn up the planet, then no one will give you laurels for having come up with the best available excuse to do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, your grandchildren still won't be proud of you. And we may have an irreversible situation. That's my first reaction. Secondly, because all these developing countries have to be worried about the problems at hand, feeding the people that are there, educating them, providing basic health care, having some near-term economic strategy, I think that people like me who care about this stuff have to find economically attractive options for them. And I think that's true by and large in the developed countries as well. You know, take a great example. France does well with greenhouse gas emissions because they generate so much electricity from nuclear, right? But they still have issues. So Mayor Delanoy, you know, is in Paris, has got this bicycle movement. Now he's thinking about going to rent electric cars that can be rented, just like the bicycles. But we're doing a project with him there to retrofit 660 elementary schools. Well, because we got the economics worked out, this is actually going to save money for the school system, freeing up money to put into teacher salaries or better education for the kids or whatever, and give the utility back electricity capacity that is far cheaper than building a new nuclear power plant would be. So if you find ways that work, that are economically beneficial, I think we've got 5 or 10 years worth of low-hanging fruit to pick before we have to get into these real arguments. Let me just give you one other example. Biggest problem with Kyoto was the United States bugged out on it. So it gave everybody an excuse to take a dive, you know. But the second biggest problem was that except for the former communist countries that were running prior to 1990, very dirty, carbon-based, inefficient, heavy industrial economies that couldn't possibly come back in the way they were, therefore they could easily meet their Kyoto targets. Okay, so we take them off. There's about 155 countries left. Only 6 or 8 of those countries are going to meet their targets. That's the second big tragedy. No one ever talks about that.
Why not?
Because I think, first, most people don't know. I really think most people don't know that. Even a lot of my friends in the environmental movement were stunned when, you know, they all know after I left office and Al and I were gone that the Bush administration took us out. But, you know, America was just like all these other countries. The Senate voted unanimously not to support Kyoto before I left office. Everybody forgets that. But look at the countries that are going to do it. Just look at the economic performance of Denmark and the UK. Now, the UK's been hit a little bit now because of you have a disproportionate impact of the rising oil prices because you have high fuel taxes and you're in the EU cap on the budget deficit, you know. But before that, your economic performance and the democratic small d distribution of it was far better than most European countries and far better than the United States. And I believe, and Gordon Brown, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, believed that it was because of the distribution of new jobs being created by the commitment to meet the Kyoto targets 2 years early. Mm. Nobody has outperformed Denmark. They are going to meet their Kyoto targets by what everyone knows. They're generating more and more electricity from the wind, but not as many people know that they also grew their economy 50% without using one more watt of electricity, which is a stunning statistic. But as a result, you look at, they had a change of government during this period. Didn't matter who was in. They had broad-based, well-distributed economic growth, more new jobs, more new businesses, and no increased inequality. I think that's what I should be doing. I mean, I'm not a government, and I don't have access to this vast amount of money, and I'm frustrated that even when the Democrats are in, we still haven't given a tax credit, for example, for wind energy that goes more than 3 years. I would like to see them do it a decade. We could triple, quadruple, quintuple wind energy production in the U.S. almost overnight if we just had the longer time horizon. But nonetheless, somebody needs to go out there and help people figure out how to do this stuff. That's what I do. I just try to figure out, and I try to get other smart people around who figure out how to do this, because I was so struck by all these countries that won't meet their Kyoto targets. Most of them were not led by people who were dishonest when they signed Kyoto. They aren't lazy, they aren't stupid, and they aren't corrupt. They're well-meaning, hard-working people who are, like all political leaders, facing all kinds of competing pressures in an economy that is not organized for tomorrow's energy, it's organized for yesterday's. One reason I went all the way up there to that little village today is that little village is now organized for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll go home now, and I'll be able to tell people that I went to the highlands of Ethiopia and saw a classroom with 2 LED lights. Nobody will believe that. And that it works economically for them.
It's fantastic, isn't it? If they can be ahead of us, they can jump ahead.
Yeah. And the reason is, if you think about it, because those lights, yeah, they cost a lot more money, but they can't afford the front-end cost anyway, right? So this is like, for them, a mini power plant. But if you look at all the solar costs and all these efficient light bulb costs, they share one thing in common. all the burdens are up front, all the benefits string out. Mm-hmm. But if you can get out, the benefits way outweigh the burdens.
Absolutely. I better jump in and ask you some health questions quickly.
Good.
You've got, this is probably the area that people know about as far as your foundation is concerned more. Certainly on the prices of drugs that you've brought down, do you think that we're going to be able to treat as many people as we need to treat? You're obviously, what you're doing is assisting in that, isn't it? Are we going the right way? Are you managing to do as much as you need to do?
I think if we're going to meet these targets, there's going to, given the resource constraints, that now this new budget passed by the U.S. Congress and signed by President Bush is really, really helpful. Big money. And it may get some more money out of others. But you have to assume there'll be the inevitable economic problems and pressures on climate change and all this. If you look at where we are, I think if we're going to meet the targets we need to meet in treatment, we're going to have to ramp up the prevention, particularly in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, which we're talking about here. I think that more and more of the purchases are going to have to come on the generic side. And it may be that as we move further and further down the road, even more and more of the big pharmaceutical companies will support generic substitutes, particularly for the first-line drugs. I think that this latest deal we did with artemisinin and the ACT therapy is quite important. And I think we're going to have to see, we've got 6 or 7 countries now where it's clearly the behavior changes are kicking in again on the prevention side. I think we're going to have to see more of that. But even with this new chunk of money the United States appropriated, I think if you just run the numbers, if you want to treat everybody within the amount of money that's been allocated, we're going to have to use more generics. I mean, for example, there are now about 3 million people on the non-pediatric drugs. When we started, like January 2003, let's say, there were 200,000 in developing countries, including the middle-income countries like Brazil had 2/3 of those. So in the countries where we work, about 1.4 million of those that have been, so half of those that have been added are people buying medicine from our contracts, these generic contracts. About 1.4 million are paid for directly by the United States government program. Now, this is a misstatement because, as you know, Doctors Without Borders does something. And so there is some small overlap. And I consider it a great victory. I mean, President Bush and I had a conversation on the way to the Pope's funeral in which I pleaded with him to move away from the pharmaceutical company stranglehold on the American money because they were paying $1,500 a person a year. And to his credit, he set up a system which said if the American Food and Drug Administration approved the generic drugs, then PEPFAR money could be spent on them in the countries where they wanted to. I think after the next election, there'll have to be a bigger move in that direction if the money we've got is going to cover the patients that have to be covered. And I think the same thing will be true. You know, we'll have to keep working the treatments for malaria. We're going to have to keep, you know, every place they put out. Look at the Ethiopian example. We didn't have anything to do with this. Look at the Ethiopian example. You give everybody 2 bed nets in the country. Mm-hmm. And then do something about ACTs and work it out based on the economics in every country, we could get a hold of this malaria thing in a hurry.
Yeah.
So that's basically what I think. I just don't think there's enough money now. I think more than enough money sloshing around in the system if we can put it in the right places. One real problem with American foreign aid, and this is not a criticism of the Bush administration. This was true when I was president. And I was always embarrassed by it. But American foreign aid and other governments' foreign aid, is that the gross numbers can be misleading because, in general, about half of all foreign assistance dollars in rich countries are spent in the country that sells, you know, to hire people at the government agencies, and they have consultants and all like that. Some of it's justified, but we need to take another look at all that, too.
Mm. Absolutely. Circumcision. You made a huge push for this, didn't you, at the Toronto AIDS conference? I remember reporting this.
Yeah.
Are you disappointed at the take-up so far?
Yeah, but I think that, yes, I am. But I do believe that I think you're going to see more of it. It's disappointed, yes, but surprised, no. I mean, keep in mind, this is a huge cultural change that involves some physical pain at a time when most of the new cases are going to women.
So therefore less incentive to men to get themselves.
Yes, but I'll be surprised if you don't see a steady gain in the practice of circumcision. Mm-hmm. Because the data is just too overwhelming. I mean, there's been no contradictory evidence to the apparent fact that you reduce your chances of contracting the virus by 60% if you're circumcised.
Are you going to say something more about this in Mexico, do you think?
I would imagine so, yeah. Because I think in Mexico now, everything will of necessity be flowing from these last numbers. So people will be looking at this from the point of view of the last numbers and then whatever it is they do in this area. One of the things that you can't calculate, even from what we see these last numbers, is, and this is a caveat, I have to say what I told you about the money, how quickly will more people have to have the second line drugs to stay alive? And are we going to be able to get the volumes up enough to get the prices down so that people can still afford to do it? So that's a big unknown money question, I think. The rest of it's all system stuff like circumcision and whatever, and like what we do here, building out healthcare systems and all that. Mm-hmm.
Do you think we've got the AIDS pandemic? Well, I remember writing it that it's slowing down. That seems to be the message out of the UN AIDS report you were talking about.
I agree with that.
Do you think it's slowing down enough? You know, have we got it almost under control here? What's happening, do you think?
I don't think you can tell yet. You need 3 or 4 more years of steady progress on the numbers. There's still more new cases every year than more people are being added to treatment every year. It's not quite apples and apples, but you get the idea. There's still a heck of a lot of people coming infected every year. And there are discrete populations making comeback, and including we have a pretty high infection rate among African Americans in the U.S. And we now know, you see the genetics, the study last week that came out saying apparently that the thing that makes African Americans and Africans more vulnerable to the AIDS virus is a genetic variation that was developed over a long time in defense of other invasions, but what it does inadvertently makes you more vulnerable to the HIV virus.
Yeah. It's a no-win, isn't it? It really is.
Well, it's just, you just learn and go. Mm. But so, Mike, I'm not prepared to say we're on the downhill slide yet. We're doing more stuff better. But I think we've got to make this money go further. And we've got to get these healthcare systems up so we can go to universal treatment. And we've got to get to literally universal mother-child transmission treatment. The transmission rate of the virus in developing countries is still about 30%. And it's 2% for everybody that properly takes the medication and goes through the regime, gets nutrition and all like that. That's a very big deal, and that's a staggering difference.
Yeah.
If you can stop the kids from getting it and then, make a little headway on the circumcision and see if these cultural behavior changes that we see in some countries can be spread more widely, then I'd be prepared to say we got it on the downhill slide, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I was interested to see you had the younger generation of your family with you today from the foundation. This is your daughter and your nephew. Is it Tiger? Is that right?
Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R.
Oh, sorry. Is this going to be a family affair, do you think? Is this in the way that some foundations are?
Well, I don't know. My daughter, took an indefinite leave of absence from her job. And she was kind of coming down after the campaign, and she's always been interested in what I do. And she knows a very great deal about healthcare. She worked, when she worked for McKinsey, she worked in the UK when Tony Blair was still PM. You remember they set up those trust hospitals?
Oh, yeah.
The idea was that these hospitals would operate a little more on their own, have slower backlogs, quicker uptake, more control of their own decisions if they produced high levels. So she worked with the McKinsey team that set those up.
Really? The Foundation Trust?
Yeah. She spent 5 months there.
Incredible.
Her first love has always been sort of healthcare and healthcare policy, although she's done a lot of other things. So she, and she wasn't the back at a new task yet, so she wanted to come with me. And I love it.
That's
you know, we like to travel together.
Yeah. And you mentioned the campaign. Can I ask you?
My nephew now, he likes the energy stuff.
Yeah. Does he?
He's just 14.
Yeah.
He's going into high school in America. But I saw him talking to his dad. He said, look at these bulbs. See, this is the future. Africa's beating America to the future. This is crazy. He's always on his father to put in some compact fluorescent bulbs and all that good stuff. It's great.
Fantastic. Have to have him on site.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
He was so happy. He loved it.
Can I just ask you briefly about the campaign? Are you incredibly stressed by it, disappointed? How do you feel now that it's all over?
Oh, I'm immensely proud of Hillary. And I think her performance in March, April, and May into June 3rd was literally miraculous. If you had told me, given the facts that existed on March 1st, she could come back, win more popular votes, do as well as she did, I would never have believed it. So I'm disappointed that she didn't get the nomination. I think she would have been the best president. But that's not what happened. And it was the only, you got to remember, it was only the second election she was ever in, really, because she had no campaign for re-election last time.
Yeah.
She had one tough race for election and this race. And I thought she learned, she grew, and I think, by the end, she was running like a house of fire. I'm very proud of her, and I'm going to do what she asked me to do. We're, going to be grateful for what we did and grateful for what we have and try to help Senator Obama get elected.
Why do you think Barack Obama won?
Oh, I think for one thing, he's in a appealing candidate, and he did better in the caucus states. It's not complicated. She won slightly more popular votes, even though she was badly outspent. He had more pledged delegates, and at the end, she was also running very well against John McCain. In all the polls, the Electoral College polls, she looked great. But it is what it is, and I'm very grateful, actually, personally, that I had a chance to get out and see so much of America, because her only option after she lost all those caucuses in February and knew she was going to be outspent was to raise this incredible grassroots campaign. Chelsea made 450 appearances for her mother.
Gosh.
In the last 3 months alone, I went to 300 different communities. I made like 1,000 appearances over the course, but I went to 350 just in the last 3 months. So I got to see parts of America I never saw when I was running or serving. And it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. And I believe then and believe now she's the best qualified person I ever supported in the primary for president. The best candidate I ever worked for. So I just loved it. It was a great honor, and we had lots of fun doing it. And I wish it had been different, but it didn't. And I'm going to do... Hillary's been great about this. She's gotten out there. She's worked hard for Obama. She's raised money for him. She's campaigned for him. And, we've been doing this a long time. I just want very much the country to change course. I want us to be on a different economic course, a different social policy course, a different course in the world. And we're going to do what we can to be helpful.
You weren't put out by the criticisms that were made of you?
No, it's all part of the deal. What we were doing was working, so you have to assume that there's going to be some blowback.
Mm.
It's a contact sport, politics.
Absolutely.
It's a contact sport, and so if what we were doing hadn't worked, then there would have been no comments and no blowback. Mm-hmm. It's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
And, I would never have gotten back into politics if it hadn't been for Hillary, but I felt so strongly that, she should be elected, and she needed all of us. She needed Chelsea. She needed me with our bodies made up for the financial disparity a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we threw ourselves into the fray and did our best. And, you just get up and go on. I lost 2 elections in my career. You just go on. You never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm immensely proud of her, but I think, she's the political leader of our family now. I'm not in politics. And I'm going to do exactly what she says we should do, and I agree with her decision. I think she's been big and positive, and that's what we should all do.
Mm. Fantastic. Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
I enjoy it. Thank you.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.